Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Sunnik Journal with Dr. Tom Sunnik. Dr. Tomislav Sunnik is an author and translator, as well as a former professor and Croatian diplomat. Visit his website for interviews, books, essays, and more at tomsunnik.info. And now here's your host, Tom Sunnik.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, depending where you are. This is Tom Sunnik, Dr. Tom or Sunnik, Dr. Tomislav Sunnik from Croatia. And I'm pleased to have you on board. And I'm always pleased to have special guests on my show. And I'm very pleased to welcome this time Dr. Roger Devlin. Dr. Roger Devlin, good evening or good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have folks who write for the Occidental Quarterly, and I'm very pleased also to announce you, and I'm very pleased also that you contribute some very fine pieces to the Occidental Quarterly on sexism, on feminism, on different issues. By the by, I also read recently your review of my favorite author I grew up with, so to speak, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and yes. I guess it was crossing my mind, and I'm sure we'll talk about this because we got many, many things to cover here. And I'm very pleased also to announce to our listeners that you are also an author of a very good book on Alexander Kojève, as they call him in France, or Kojève. Would you be willing, Dr. Devlin, would you be willing to give us a little bit of real simple background of Alexander Kojève? I'll tell you quite frankly, I've heard of him. Even when I was a boy here in communist Yugoslavia, I heard about this philosopher. But I tend to a little bit biased against leftist thinkers because I've had enough of them. So please apologize my ignorance, but I'll give you a word. And I certainly would be pleased if you could situate it, if you could put Kojève in the right perspective for our distinguished audience.
All right. Alexander Kojève was born Kojevnikov in Moscow in 1902. He grew up in an affluent bourgeois family, but was not allowed to go to the university when he came of age because the Russian Revolution had intervened because of his class origin. So he escaped to Western Europe and was able to get some money from his family, though, to finance his studies in Germany and France. He attended lectures by Husserl, the phenomenologist, mm-hmm. and wrote a dissertation under the direction of Karl Jaspers. Mm-hmm. Later on, he moved to France, where he became a lecturer at the Sorbonne, at the University mm-hmm. of Paris. And in the 1930s, he gave a very famous series of lectures on the philosophy of Hegel. Now, Hegel is an extremely difficult thinker to interpret, and famously there have been what are called right-wing and left-wing Hegelians. Mm-hmm. And Kojève was a type of left-wing Hegelian. He interpreted Hegel as an atheist and as a kind of ultra-modern and anti-traditional thinker, which is questionable, of course. Now, Kojève distinguished sharply between what he called a commentary and an interpretation. Mm-hmm. A commentary on a philosopher is an attempt to explain the philosopher in the philosopher's own terms. Mm-hmm. And an interpretation is a kind of appropriation or original making use of a philosopher's idea for one's own purposes.
Like value judgments? Like giving value judgments about somebody, right? Am I correct? Interpretation versus commentary. Like, I assume that when you make an interpretation of a given author, you're also providing value judgments. Am I correct?
Yes, I suppose you could put it that way. Mm-hmm. He used Hegel as a means to understand the world, as a kind of a a helper in his own philosophical project. So if you wanted to know exactly a historically correct understanding of Hegel, perhaps Kojève would not be the first person you would go to. But he's a lot more interesting than some of the more careful commentators. He's a philosopher in his own right, and he developed what is, in my view, the purest form of philosophical modernism. He was, how shall I say, he represents the kind, as you might say, left-wing type of modern political thought in its most extreme and also its most consistent and interesting form. I'm not a disciple of Kojève, as you might guess from my writing for the Occidental Quarterly, but I found him a completely fascinating man and a much clearer and more consistent type of thinker than most of the heroes of the left, such as Marx and Rousseau.
May I ask you, excuse me, Dr. Devlin, what prompted you, if I may ask you a personal question, what prompted you to delve into Kojève? I mentioned a while ago he is associated with this quote-unquote leftist body of thought, and what prompted you to actually become so interested and, so to speak, associated with his thought?
Yes, it was partly a matter of chance. Kojève had been recommended to me as somebody to read to help me understand Hegel. And I just picked up his book at a used bookstore one day and started reading in an effort to understand Hegel. And I only gradually became more interested in Kojève than in Hegel himself. Also, one group of people who are very interested in Kojève without being leftists are the followers of Leo Strauss.
Okay.
Yes. Strauss and Kojève were personal friends and philosophical rivals. They were very different in their intellectual orientations and their political orientations, but they were very good friends and they corresponded. And I got to be quite interested in their dialogue, which they carried on over over the course of many years. And this is, if anyone's interested, you can get the third edition of Leo Strauss's On Tyranny, and it has the complete correspondence and the complete dialogue between Strauss and Kojève.
Now, Mr. Devlin, let's come to the point, if I may. What exactly is your main body of thought? What exactly is your main thesis in your book on Kojève? Or if I could put it that way, is it more interpretative or is it more of a commentary type of a book?
Well, Kojève's thinking is not very systematically presented in his own writings. It can be confusing when you first encounter him. He seems to be just commenting on Hegel. What I did in my book was to try to write the kind of book I wish I had when I started studying him. It's an introductory study to him. It's an introduction to his thought, and it places him in a very different context than has been done hitherto. Usually, Kojève is discussed as an influence on certain other French thinkers or a Marxist, as another figure of the 20th century to be discussed in relation to men like Jacques Lacan or Jean-Paul Sartre. I have a much higher regard for Kojève as a thinker, and I have put him in the context of writers like Aristotle, Thomas Hobbes, and Hegel himself. And insofar as my book has its thesis, it's that Kojève's philosophy is the logical culmination of modern thought. Modern thought being the direction that philosophy took in Machiavelli and Hobbes and Rousseau. It's the kind of nec plus ultra of modern philosophy, or logical extreme, and it's the most consistent and radical form of modern thought.
Could you be a little bit more specific, Dr. Devlin, and tell me exactly, because unfortunately this term, this concept of modern thought has been so much abused, and I would like you to be a little bit more specific within the context of Alexander Kojève, please.
Well, Hegel represents a kind of thinking known as historicism, historicism, which is understood by way of contrast to the tradition of natural law and of human nature. The ancients believed that that human beings have a timeless nature. For example, the historian Thucydides, in his great history, says that human beings will always have the same nature, and that therefore a history such as he wrote is timeless and will be understood by people 2,000 years from now. Now, in more recent thought, there has been a great deal of emphasis on the relation of thought to the times in which people live. For example, it is thought that there was a pagan mind and then a Christian or medieval mind, which could not really communicate with each other because they were historically situated. And they had... And so in order to understand a philosophy, you need to understand the time in which it was enunciated. Hegel said that philosophy is its time, its age, comprehended in thought.
So if you allow me, Dr. Devlin, in other words, scholars or would-be scholars, young people who listen to us who might be studying tomorrow in humanities, they should, if I understand you correctly, they should put the author in his time frame first. For instance, if they study Machiavelli, they should be familiar what was going on in the 16th, 17th, or 15th, 16th century in Italy. Or for instance, if they study Hegel, they should be familiar what was going on after the Napoleon Revolution. Am I correct?
Right.
So this is, you mentioned the fascinating word historicity. And pardon me if we are so didactic. Could you please explain to my students, should I say, to my distinguished students and audience, what exactly historicity means? Because I'm sure you're aware this is a very tricky topic, particularly in Germany, because it sometimes creates some bad synonyms, if I can put it that way.
I don't think I used the term historicity. I think I said historicism.
Historicism. Yes, please. Yeah. Thank you very much for reminding me of that. Yes.
In German, Historismus instead of Geschichtlichkeit. Well, this is the doctrine. This is it comes in moderate and extreme views, in versions. An extreme historicist would say that you cannot understand Machiavelli without understanding the politics of the 16th century Italy. There are more moderate historicists who just say that that his view of human beings may be timeless, and only the examples that he points to are drawn from the age of the age in which he lived. It's certainly a good idea for anybody who's studying a thinker to have a little idea about his context. I myself am not really a radical historicist as Kojève was. I think that it is perfectly possible to put Kojève into dialogue with men who were not of his time, such as Hobbes and Aristotle, and that's what I do in my book. So I'm writing an account of this historicist form of thought, but the account is not itself historicist. I actually owe more to Leo Strauss in my views of the history of philosophy, the history of thought.
You mentioned again, let me just dwell for a second longer, Dr. Devlin, on historicismus, as the Germans call it. I'm sure you're aware, and we don't want to get into that topic of revisionism and historicism, because again, there's always a catch-22, as we say here in Europe. When you push a certain argument too far, you always risk, in fact, there is a chance that this argument can come back after you and against you, so to speak. But I would certainly appreciate if you could just develop a little bit more of this thesis of historicism a little bit. How is it in America, in American scholarship, and how is it seen? Because I see you have a fascinating culture. How is it seen in Europe?
Well, first of all, let me say that my book, it doesn't actually use very technical language. It's somewhat easier, maybe, to understand than some of the ideas we're discussing right now, because I start with very simple ideas, very simple examples.
Thank you. That's good.
It is an introduction to these questions, and I think I only get to the question of historicism at the end of the book. It's the last thing I discuss. Kojève is notorious for having claimed that history is over. He's the one who originated the thesis of the end of history, which in America is best known, I think, through an author named Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book called The End of History and the Last Man.
Mm-hmm.
And Fukuyama was a student of Alan Bloom's also. Mm-hmm. The end of history is an attempt to bring historicism, radical historicism, into harmony with the idea of a final philosophical truth. Kojève believed that thought is time-bound. It has limitations based on its historical context, but that there was a kind of absolute moment in history where an unsurpassable and complete form of thought became possible for the first time. And he believed this occurred during Hegel's life, that in effect, by the time of Hegel's writing, history had led human beings through all the possible cultural forms that could exist, and that therefore Hegel's thought would be essentially valid for all time to come. He said once that the independence of Togo was simply the arrival of the French Revolution in Africa. In other words, history after the time of Hegel can be understood completely within the terms that were possible in Hegel's own time.
Mm-hmm.
That nothing essentially new had happened since Hegel's own time.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Devlin, let me ask you if we can just get a little bit more specific for all, uninitiated
yes.
listeners. How do we, if I can put it bluntly, how do we square away Kojève or Kojevsky with our modern or our postmodern decadent society? What can we learn? What can we actually extirpate from Kojève and his erudition? No question about that.
Okay.
And to what extent, given his leftist background, and this is the way he is being portrayed still, even his Stalinists will come to that, how does it, let me say, if I can just put it bluntly, how can a young nationalist or a conservative, a right-winger, whatever, just a normal straight fellow, a white straight fellow in the United States of America, what can he learn, how can he benefit by reading your book and by reading Kojève?
Oh, to me, Kojève is the great opponent. As I say, I'm not a disciple of Kojève. I'm very interested in him, and I have a great deal of respect for him. But I'm not a follower, and I'm not trying to get people to believe everything that he believed. Sometimes he described himself as a Marxist. I think even as a Stalinist, but I think that this was mainly to try to shock people a little bit. It was he did enjoy being outrageous, and certainly in his own life, he does not seem to have been a Stalinist. His philosophical ideas have nothing in common with what was being taught in the Soviet Union at the time as Marxist philosophy. He was always much more interested in Hegel than Marx, and that's a good sign because Hegel was a much greater, a much more important thinker than Marx. He was attacked also by communist intellectuals who called him a fascist and so forth.
He did not
really toe the Stalinist line, either politically or philosophically.
But he was part of the establishment in France, wasn't he? I guess he worked for the government as well, or at least he was associated with the government. With
That's
the Fourth
right,
Republic,
after the war.
Or the Fifth Republic, yes, it was during de Gaulle, right? It was back in the late 50s and 60s, am I correct?
He got a job with the government right after the World War II. During the war, he was in the resistance, actually. He worked for the French resistance. And then he got a job with the government and worked for the government for the rest of his life until his death in 1968. So that was under the Fourth and Fifth Republic. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the founders of the European Economic Community, which now has become the monster known as the EU. It's very difficult to say what he would think of the EU today. It certainly has changed in directions that he could not have foreseen.
What's an interesting thing, I'm sure, if we can just put it in a somewhat larger framework, I'm sure you realize, and I'm sure you know this probably even better than me, that even after the Bolshevik Revolution, there were many, many, literally many, probably, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands, but there were certainly thousands of Russians, even Russian intellectuals, who fled Russia, which turned Soviet, and they were extremely, in fact, there is even a tradition, this tradition of anti-communism. Now, here we have Solzhenitsyn, for instance, we're going to talk about him a little bit. So I'm surprised a little bit on my personal level, even that he was, so to speak, he was eye-goggling, what's the right word, he was sort of causing up a little bit to this leftist cause, like most. Even I know some relatives of some Russians, French Russians, who are extremely anti-communist, they're very anti-liberal, and very right-wingish, if you wish. So that's something I'm puzzled with as far as Kozhev is concerned.
It is puzzling. I can't really solve the problem. He did, as a practical matter, he did not have a high opinion of Stalin or the leaders of the Soviet Union. And in fact, some of the people who worked with Kozhev in the French government very closely were of the opinion that he was a reactionary in practical matters. A man named Olivier Vormsier, who was just about his closest associate in the government, says that he always thought Kozhev was a reactionary. And one of the main differences between Kozhev and other leftists is really the level of sophistication. He was so much more intelligent than most of the other leftists of his time. But he believed that the Soviet Union, awful as it was, represented a kind of fulfillment of history as interpreted by Hegel. He believed that human beings were evolving toward what he called the universal homogeneous state. That is, he would not have been surprised at all by the growth of international bodies since his death and the attempts to install a universal human rights court at The Hague, for example. He believed that this was the tendency of history, whether you like it or not. You know, it's something that had to be accepted.
Excellent. But let me, I certainly would like to encourage my listeners to get a hold of your book and to read you a little bit more and to become a little bit more acquainted with Kozhev. I'll tell you quite frankly, I'm still a little bit puzzled with Kozhev because I'm sure you're aware of the fact that he was of a Gentile background. He was an aristocratic Slavic background. And yet there are quite a few of, in fact, de Gaulle in his first government in the Fourth Republic had a couple of communist ministers. And of course, the French intellectuals, there was a very staggering number of Jewish, also of Russian Jewish backgrounds. So there was sort of a quote-unquote a civil war under quotation going on in France after the Second World War, even in the intellectual life, because Paris itself, I'm sure aware of that, is still a sort of a clashing point where the left, the intellectual left meets the intellectual right. So, Dr. Devlin, I certainly, if I may ask you a few technical questions, do you have a website where I can redirect
no.
my... Oh, so... I
No, unfortunately, I don't. My book, some selections from it are on Google Books, but unfortunately, the only way to really get it is to pay $32 for it from Amazon.com. it is, as I say, a little easier than some of the ideas we're discussing. It's the basic importance of Kojève, in my view, is that he really lays bare what are the most fundamental differences between the left and the right.
Excellent.
If you want to get a grasp on what is truly essential about the left and the right, you can do it by studying Kojève.
Thank you. Dr. Devlin, let's take a little break and we'll be right back. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure.
We'll be right back with the Sunik Journal. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, our next story, global warming. Not a story, but really a heated debate that's continuing because some scientists claim that there's no credible data to support the fact that the Earth is actually warming up. John Christie, a professor at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, joins me live to share his thoughts on this topic. Hi there, John. Yeah. So you're actually a former lead author on the IPCC, and now you're questioning whether or not temperature records can actually be a reliable indicator of global climate change. Can you elaborate? I mean, why this shift?
Well, what I say is that the popular data sets really can't tell us a lot about global warming from the greenhouse effect. I think everyone agrees that the world has warmed in the past 150 years, but the question is why? And I think some of these popular surface data sets just really don't tell you the reason that that warming has occurred.
So you said that you're not doubting the fact that climate change is real. You're saying that it does exist, but are you saying that it's not contingent upon human activities then?
Well, what we found is that the human activities that create this warming in many of these thermometers is due to things like cities being built and farms being established and forests being taken down. Now, these are truly human effects, but they really don't change the entire global climate too much. And for that, we look for things like satellite data, which show the warming is less than what is promoted in the media.
You know, we've seen more and more skeptics sort of come to the forefront on this issue and kind of challenge it. Even the IPCC has corrected its previous stances before. Can we still trust this institution then if we've seen all these examples of perhaps inaccurate reports that they had to sometimes then apologize for?
Well, what you find is that the IPCC produces what its lead authors write, and those are selected by governments and by the UN IPCC itself. So when they select people who are worried about global warming, you will get an official report that is supposed to make you worry about global warming.
So you're saying that there's an agenda behind it. But I also want to ask you, today is the fifth anniversary of the Kyoto Protocol, its entry into force at least. Looking back now, do you think it's done more harm or good?
Well, the Kyoto Protocol means absolutely nothing to the global climate. The emissions of CO2 are still rising, even in the countries that tried to sign up for it, by and large. So it was really a non-event in terms of what climate is. But I think it has done more harm by giving people the notion that they can control the climate by reducing their energy consumption, when in fact energy is really the basis for modern life today.
John Christie, thank you so much for your analysis. Definitely a heated debate here in the United States, kind of becoming politicized as well, climate change. Thank you for your analysis.
And now let's return to the Sunik Journal. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is your host, Tomislav Sunic, or Tom Sunic, or Tom. This is much better. And again, I am pleased to have a very special guest, Dr. Devlin, Roger Devlin, on my show tonight. And we are discussing some very, quote-unquote, heavy-duty topics about Hegelianism. And can you, of course, we got things to cover. You wrote quite a bit about sex and this sexual warfare, as they call it nowadays. I'll tell you, I like your style. It's very, how can I say, it's very polished. It's not very flowery. There are not too many epithets. It's very, I don't want to say it's cold, but it's very calm. And I guess by your style, I can tell what your personality is. But you make some very good points about this quote-unquote gender warfare. And
yeah.
I would have probably used a somewhat starker and harsher language against the leftists, but you are much calmer and much better, much more academic. And could you please tell me something about this, I call it this fraud, rather, but the sexual warfare, this disruption.
The fraud of feminism and the sexual revolution, yeah.
Yes, that's the way I call it, but you probably don't call it that way in your prose, but I call it the fraud, literally.
Yes. So.
Biggest fraud, what can I say, both the intellectual fraud, both the legal, if you wish, what we have with this affirmative action and gender studies.
Yes.
And I read those two pieces of yours on sex, and one was published separately, the other one in the Occidental Quarterly.
Yes.
So could you please just develop a little bit the thesis about the sex warfare and how those gender, how gender roles have been completely put upside down?
It's amazing that here in the year 2010, we're explaining to people that boys and girls are different from each other. The difference between the sexes, you see, is an obstacle to the left's dream of a completely homogeneous society, of what my old friend Kojève would call the universal homogeneous state. A society cannot be completely homogeneous, cannot consist of completely equal beings as long as there are men and women. So great efforts have been undertaken in the 20th century to deny or to downplay or to cover up the difference between the sexes. And in particular, to undermine the traditional family, the male-headed family, and to replace it with a view of sex which seems to be modeled on a homosexual bathhouse, really. The whole ideal of sexual liberation is based on the idea of human beings as interchangeable, pleasure-seeking monads, any one of which is like any other of which. So that instead of sexual morality being based upon the institution of marriage, there has been an attempt to reconceptualize it as based on the idea of consent, as they say, between consenting adults, and anything is permissible between consenting adults. And this runs aground on the difference between men and women. The simple fact is that both men and women end up not happier, but less happy and less satisfied in a world where sex is regulated on the basis of consent instead of marriage. Mm-hmm. The pattern that emerges when people are told to do whatever they like is that women all mate with high-status men, and a large number of men are not able to get wives, and the women, they're able to mate, but they're not able to get husbands. They're, as they say, they're not able to get this small number of high-status men to commit to them. Mm-hmm. And the reason, they think the reason that these men that they're sleeping with won't commit to them is just because the men are wicked. The real reason is arithmetic. There are only a few very high-status men. Mm-hmm. And obviously they cannot marry and be monogamous with all the women who would like to mate with them. So the result is that both women and men become extremely frustrated and tend to have a lower view of each other than in a traditional monogamous society. Mm-hmm. That's the basic idea of my my main essay. It's called Sexual Utopia in Power.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you may be familiar with the book Utopia in Power about the Soviet Union.
Oh, yes, I'm very. It was published, yes, down in, in Stanford University, Random House.
I see a very strong analogy between feminism in power and Soviet rule, really. It's an attempt to force human beings into a utopian mold that just does not fit them.
Dr. Devlin, let's try to be a little bit direct. Of course, you are discussing very eloquently about those perverted roles in a modern postmodern society, men versus women, almost like on a warpath. But
yes.
I was wondering, I've read very good essays, similar essays to yours, also by Yves Christen, probably are familiar, he's a sexologist in France, very close to the European right, and it's written very, in a very good fashion about this quote-unquote, this utopia, this fraud that we call the sexual liberation. He's a very prominent sociobiologist, but also quite close to Alain de Benoist, Yves Christen. So I happen to be a little bit familiar with this fraud.
Okay.
But nonetheless, what I would like from you to find out, like from many others, I'm still, and I'm not joking, what is the root cause of the problem? Who actually brought this over? How did it happen? How did it come about in the first place? Why are so many young people, young males, not just in the United States, but also in Croatia, unhappy? Why they're in the 20s, 30s, they can't find themselves a woman for a variety of reasons. And what caused that in the first place, this disruption of the traditional family?
Feminism is literally an ancient idea. You can read about it in Aristophanes, the congresswoman. It's a play in the 4th century BC about women who take over the state and try to introduce all kinds of wild sexual legislation to make everybody equal.
Yes, so I remember that passage of yours. It's a very good passage that you wrote, right?
Yes, it's not a recent idea, although feminists like to think of themselves as very modern and progressive. Mm-hmm. And you can see in 19th century feminism, when it really got to be a mass movement, if you look back to the Seneca Fold Conference in America in the 19th century, you will see the women then saying very radical things. It's a sort of a myth that feminism used to be moderate. There's really never been a moderate feminism. In recent years, I don't know. The current wave, as they say, of feminism is a post-war phenomenon. It began with Simone de Beauvoir in France and Betty Friedan in the United States. I think it has something to do with prosperity, really. I think it has something to do with post-war economic prosperity. A lot of women were simply bored. They had leisure to go to school. They'd been to school. I think there's a connection between women thinking they're oppressed and actually being, having all their material needs easily met. Most women in history were too busy taking care of their families and preparing food to worry about men men being their oppressors. It was too obvious that men were providing for them.
I can see, Dr. Deli, you're a man of great erudition. Not only that you write about Kozhev and Solzhenitsyn, but you also write about sex and sexuality. Just before we come to our next point, to our next segment and next subject, I was wondering, would you make, because I do myself, at least in some of my pieces and in some of my speeches, I make a distinction between femininity and feminism. I am femininity, but I am against feminism. I think you also mentioned that, if you allow me, you talk about real femininity among old Nordic women. They had a thing, you know, Thingsveli, where women actually had much more right in a sense than men in a sense. And this is an old primeval Indo-European tradition, which is certainly which I'm certainly proud of. And could you just develop that a little bit, please?
Yes, this is true. It seems to be a cultural trait of the European people to ascribe women a high status. Certainly when you compare our civilization to that of even other relatively well-developed civilizations such as Japan or China. This is something that we do not owe to feminism. It may be that the traditional high status of women in European society has made us more vulnerable to the claims of feminism, because feminism does claim to want to give women high status.
Absolutely.
And that's something that European people naturally want to do. We really want to give women an important role in our society, but we don't want to do it in the way that feminism would instruct us to do it. We do it, of course, by more or less putting women in control of the domestic sector, limiting men to the public sector.
But Dr. Devlin, I'm sure you will agree with me, there are great women in our society, in European society,
yes,
who did a spectacular job. Look at Isabella II in Spain. She threw out the infidels, the Muslims. She actually she made us civilized in a sense. Look at Maria Antonietta. She was of Austrian birth. She actually lost her head because of those crazy revolutionaries came in. And think of Maria Theresa, right? What is his name?
Yes, of course. And there are all kinds of wonderful, interesting women in even ancient European literature.
Absolutely. And look at this. When you say, for instance, in Croatia is a very Catholic country, when you say Maria Theresa, every Flemish guy, every guy in Bavaria, everybody in Croatia knows that she was a great woman. You know, not just she was a leader. She was a leader of a huge empire. So I guess this is something that needs to be brought back to the leftists, that not all women were just cooking and what they say. And I'm glad that you have tackled this topic. It's a fascinating topic indeed.
Yeah. Feminists want to make women believe that they owe their current possibilities to the feminist movement, and that's not true. They tend to create in women today a very dark image of the past, which does not match the facts.
Dr. Devlin, you wrote on different topics, and I certainly, since this is the dearest topic to me, communism and Solzhenitsyn, and I'm sure you are probably the expert on it, and I guess we are both a little bit, and I literally grew up with Solzhenitsyn. I'm sure you are familiar that until the fall of the wall in 1989, Solzhenitsyn was banned. He was not translated. In fact, he existed in a samizdat, in a different languages here in Eastern Europe. But even here in quote-unquote liberal communist Yugoslavia, you couldn't get a hold of Solzhenitsyn to start with until 89, 90, and in other countries as well. Then he was translated magnanimously. So could you just give me an idea? You wrote a very fascinating piece on his fascinating book, and some critics didn't like it very much, on 2,000 years together. Unfortunately, the book, to my knowledge, hasn't been translated into English yet. It does exist in German and in French. And this is his magnum opus before he died, before he passed away.
Yes.
2 years ago he died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So could you just give me first an idea of that two volumes, and then tell us a little bit more about your opinion and why this book needs translation?
Oh, okay. I'll go in reverse then. The book is called 200 Years Together. I'll speak about that and then about Solzhenitsyn. Yeah, it's a massive book. It's 1,000 pages. It's available in French and German translations as well as the original Russian. And there are translations currently underway into a number of other languages, but not English.
How do you explain that, if I may interrupt you? Why is there no attempt?
There was. I have it on good authority that Yale University Press was interested in publishing the work when it first came out in Russian back in 2001, I guess it was. And some persons described to me as Jewish heavyweights intervened with the press and were able to persuade Yale not to go through with it.
Uh-huh.
And so now, I don't know, there is a wonderful organization called the Intercollegiate Studies Institute in Delaware that is going to bring out some of Solzhenitsyn's works. They're going to bring out his memoirs of his years in America, and maybe eventually they will be able to bring out this important book, 200 Years Together, but it probably will not be soon. So I wrote this review for the Occidental Quarterly to fill a gap. A lot of people want to read the book, and they're not able to. So, unfortunately, I don't read Russian, but I worked from the French and produced a rather long, about a 50-page summary of what is in the book. It is the most extensive summary of 200 Years Together currently available in English.
Okay. Dr. Devlin, let's try to explain our folks who listen to us, our friends, what exactly are we referring to 200 years together? We are referring, of course, you mentioned that in a different context, to the Jewish question, to the Jews and how they lived in this Pale in Russia. Could you explain that to our listeners a little bit more?
Yes. There were extremely few Jews in Russia before the late 18th century. During the time of Catherine the Great, Poland was partitioned between the great powers, and this brought almost a million Jews into the Russian Empire. And they were given a certain area they were allowed to settle in. They were not allowed to settle freely all over Russia, but they were given a very large area, about twice the size of France, mostly in what is now Belarus and Ukraine, which was newly Russian territory at that time. And they lived with the Russians for a period of about 200 years, from the 1770s to the 1970s. And finally, under Gorbachev, restrictions on their travel were lifted, and they now can freely leave Russia and move to Israel or America or wherever they want. So the 200 years was the 200 years during which they were, in a sense, forced to live with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And there is a very difficult and complicated history of their interactions with Russians. Under the Tsar, Jewish rights were a great liberal cause. They were put under certain special restrictions, and there was a lot of sympathy for Russian Jews in the West because of this. Everybody knows about the famous pogroms. Solzhenitsyn recounts some of this history of the late 19th century and early 20th century pogroms. It's widely believed that the Russian government was behind the anti-Jewish pogroms, and one of Solzhenitsyn's main points is to counteract this. It's largely a myth that was due to the strong anti-Tsarist sentiment of the time. Many of the pogroms, according to Solzhenitsyn, were really in the nature of riots, popular riots. The common people in Russia were often strongly anti-Jewish because, especially in the late 19th century, because of Jewish involvement in terrorism and the revolutionary movement. The government actually was trying to prevent pogroms, but the Tsars really were not as powerful as they are sometimes made out. There was more incompetence than anything in the imperial authorities' response to the pogroms.
Dr. Devlin, excuse me, but there is a point where Solzhenitsyn also talks about the Jewish involvement in the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes.
And I'll tell you quite frankly, I enjoyed your piece, but it seems to me it was too mild. It was written by a gentleman, I couldn't tell that. But I guess there are certain things that you were not explicit enough, and neither was Solzhenitsyn, who in my view was wrongly accused of anti-Semitism, which is not true. But the fact of the matter is, even in his earlier writings, even in his books, you know, he mentions the leaders, Yagoda, Beria, and you name it, Zinoviev, Kamenev. These were all people distinctly of Jewish origin, and there's no question about that. This is a truism that a large number, almost the vast majority of early Bolsheviks were actually of Jewish origin, who also came from the United States of America. We should not forget that. The Trotsky also brought about 200 people with him. So how do you actually explain this in your review, this portion of history where he deals with Jews during the Bolshevik, or actually even the Menshevik Revolution and Bolshevik Revolution?
Yes, this is the subject of Solzhenitsyn's second volume. The Jews were very prominent in the revolutionary movement and were well positioned to take leadership roles once the revolution arrived. The different ethnic groups in Imperial Russia were not represented equally in the revolution. There were not very many Russians in the early days of the Russian Revolution in power. In general, the smaller nations were better represented, and the Latvians and the Jews were the two most overrepresented groups. And particularly during the first 20 years of communist rule, Jews were very prominent in the central government and also in what used to be the Pale of Settlement, the security forces in the Ukraine and Belarus. Were very heavily Jewish, majority Jewish.
And how do you actually come? How does Solzhenitsyn come to terms with that? And why? What made him the object, the subject of the attack by that the Yale publisher?
Oh, well, they didn't attack him. They just refused to publish his book. He has been attacked by a number of Jewish publicists. It's not too difficult to find them on the web. Solzhenitsyn does not, he's very explicit that he doesn't want to blame the revolution on the Jews or to say that it was a Jewish plot. It was not one nation that conspired to bring about the revolution. But Jews, of course, traditionally have been very suspicious of the Christian society that surrounds them. So when the revolutionary movement began, it began actually among Russians, but many Jews were strongly attracted to it. And so over time, they came to dominate it, and then, of course, eventually took a leading role in the revolution itself. It was, to some extent, a continuation of their suspicious attitude toward the Christian society that surrounded them, that made them very sympathetic to revolutionary ideas.
Excellent. That's a good point. Well, dear listeners, this is Dr. Devlin, and we are discussing about Solzhenitsyn, the Jewish question, and I'm sure, Dr. Devlin, we could go on and just change from one topic to another. Well, we have an interesting story, of course, you know, what happened with many, many, well, you mentioned a while ago, Kozhev. I'm sure you're familiar with the name Bayanov, Boris Bayanov. He was probably one of the first Jewish, actually, turned out to be a Jew. He was Jewish, a Bolshevik, but he was in France, extremely popular before the Second World War, because he actually exposed this totalitarian spirit of communism. And the interesting thing, I guess we can, and you can tell my listeners a little bit about that, that many, many of those former Bolsheviks who were of Jewish origin turned afterwards into radical anti-communists, and some of them immigrated to Israel, of course, to the United States of America. And could you tell us something about neocons or neoconservatives in America? Do they can they also fit into this picture of former Trotskyists or Bolsheviks now becoming tolerable, cool neocons?
Let me go back a little bit. The Jewish domination of the Soviet of the revolution lasted, according to Solzhenitsyn, about 20 years. A lot of Jews were purged in the Great Purge of 1937, and then, of course, Stalin entered into a pact with Hitler in 1939, and this was a great crisis for the Jewish communists of the world. All of the Jews were purged from the Soviet Foreign Office, and then even after Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, Stalin gradually diminished the influence of Jews in the Soviet Communist Party. There's no doubt that he personally was not fond of Jews, and he slowly removed Jews from positions of power. And towards the end of his life, in the early 1950s, he actually came out openly against Jews. A lot of the people who were put on show trials in the Soviet Union during the late Stalin period were Jews. So accordingly, Jews around the world began to turn against the Soviet Union. And one thing Solzhenitsyn says, he was convinced in the 1960s when Jews turned against the Soviet regime that it was finished, that it was living on borrowed time. He thought that was going to be the death blow to them when he saw the Jews become anti-communists.
Isn't that funny? That's an irony of history, Dr. Devlin. I'm very, very pleased to have had you on my show. And Dr. Devlin, quite frankly, I'm really, really looking forward to having you next time, possibly within a couple of weeks, so we can discuss on installment plans. So why not talk about the second volume of Solzhenitsyn's book? Well, thank you very much, dear listeners, and thank you. Thank you, Dr. Devlin. It was a pleasure. It was a very gentleman's discussion, and I'm enjoying having you as my guest. Thank you again.
All right, thank you.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening. The Sunik Journal with Dr. Tom Sunik will return next Tuesday from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com.